I am Paige Albiniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. Today, I am so happy and excited to be speaking with Rick Luchuk. He was formerly senior vice president, creative marketing and brand standards for CNN, and he is also a former Promax board member. And Rick, hello. Thank you so much for being here.
Nice to talk to you.
So let's start at the very beginning. How did you find your way into the business of entertainment marketing?
The old-fashioned way. I started out of college with a small television station up in Canada, and I was did everything camera, as everybody did in those days. And we had a promotions manager at the small television station, and he wasn't very good at what he did. And I just loved television. Always have loved television. So I used to stay late, and I started editing promos together and kept pitching, and the promotion manager didn't like them, but the station manager did. And so they started using them at that television station. And then a job came open, actually, for a promotion manager at a different station in a different city. And I got that job in 1982. And so I've been working in promotion, marketing, whatever we've evolved this job into since 1982 nonstop.
So what drew you to cutting promos? Like, why was that the area that you stayed late to do?
I honestly loved television. I loved everything about TV. It just excited me. I was in a television program in high school. It's what I went to college for. I was just a television nerd, just excited about everything television had to offer. And this is from somebody who grew up with one television station. You know, I didn't get a second television station until I was 12 years old. But I just, for whatever reason, I love TV. Always have.
Did you grow up in Canada, and where was your first TV job?
I grew up in a place called North Battleford, Saskatchewan. So everyone can Google that and figure out where the heck that is. And I went, the first television station I worked at was called 2 and 7 in Lethbridge, Alberta. And best thing that came out of that job, other than starting my career, it's where I met my wife, and we're still together today after over 40 years.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Okay. So that got you into the business of promo. What brought you to CNN? Which probably might be a long journey, actually.
Yeah, so, you know, from the television station where I started working in promotions was back in my home province of Saskatchewan. And that eventually grew to running promotions for six stations in Saskatchewan. And then the company that owned us brought me east to Toronto to run promotions for that whole company. And then that company bought the CTV network. And so I took over running promotions for the CTV network, and the company continued to grow. I eventually became in charge of the CTV creative agency, and we did marketing and promotion for two broadcast networks in Canada and 32 cable channels. And so it was a pretty big portfolio. It was all going swimmingly and good. And as things happen, new owners came in who I didn't quite see eye to eye with. It's their company. They can run it the way they want to. So I made the decision that I was going to leave after 32 years with that company.
Oh, wow.
I had a non-compete clause in my contract, which meant I couldn't work in television in Canada for at least a year. So that meant I had to look elsewhere. A very good friend of mine, Lisa Gregorian, was the first person I turned to for advice. And I phoned Lisa and I said, look, I haven't told anybody other than my wife this, but I'm going to leave, and I'm going to need to get a job in the UK or the US most likely. I haven't done this for a long time. Point me in the right direction. And Lisa said, Give me a week. I said, okay, I'll trust you. I'll give you a week. Within a couple of days, she came back and she said, there's this really good job I think you should look at within our company at CNN. And I'd like you to talk to the people there. And so I talked to the recruiter from CNN, and we talked. I talked numerous times with the person who was doing the hiring. I just got more and more excited about it. You know, CNN is such a great brand, and I have to remind people, I actually started working in television before CNN was even formed.
Right.
But I'd watched CNN grow through the years, and the brand was still strong, but it was struggling a little bit at that time. So the idea of being able to go and work with a brand that has had as much potential as CNN did and had such a storied past as CNN did was too big of an opportunity. And so we took that leap, and my wife, as she always does, is a willing participant, and we packed up, and I say we, most kids leave home. We left our kids and left them in Toronto, and we moved down to Atlanta, and that was a little over 10 years ago.
You were like, and we're so much warmer. No.
Well, not
people
today,
love but... Toronto. Yeah. Are you in Toronto now?
No, I haven't been in, oh, that's not true. I was in the Toronto airport last week, but no, I haven't been back to Toronto really for quite a while.
Okay. All right. So you were at CNN then for about a decade.
Correct.
Okay. So you kind of were there, past decade ended up getting kind of tumultuous, but we'll talk about that. I mean, for all of us, but we'll talk about that coming up. And then at CTV, were you in news promo, or were you in promo across the company?
The whole company, okay. News promotion. In, you know, we had Discovery, MTV, we, you know, sports channels. I did promotion for the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver. The whole gamut. I got to try everything.
Also, I want to highlight that you actually just dropped a really great piece of advice. I think not knowing that you were doing it, but you know, you were saying, after 32 years, you were like, huh, I haven't looked for a job for a while. So you did a really smart thing, which was reach out to a very well-connected, smart person and just said, hey, I don't even know where to start. What should I do? I think that's just like, the job searching thing doesn't have to be more complicated than that. But I think people forget, you know, sometimes it's calling your friends.
That's, yeah, that really is true. And I wasn't calling on Lisa for a job. I was
right.
calling on her for advice. And
right.
And that just turned into what it did.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I'm digressing for a moment, but I think that's a hindrance. You know, like for me, if I'm, because I'm contract and freelance, so if I'm looking for extra work, I go like, well, I don't want to call them and make them feel obligated. But if you're just calling like, hey, I'm looking around, just FYI, I think people like to help you.
Yeah, it absolutely. And sometimes, you know, you kind of step in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, definitely. This is a very broad question and it'll require you to pick among many, many children. But what has been some of your favorite work while you've been at CNN? And off the top of my own head, I can think of several things, but what things that you've loved?
You know, one that probably doesn't spring to mind for most people automatically, campaign we did called Go There. And there was lots of fun, the backstory of how Jeff Bukas approved that and everything else, but that's for a different day. But it was just really good. And there was one really strong piece we did that involved Wolf Blitzer and Emma Albagre. And it was a concept piece, and we really didn't know how it was going to turn out, but it involved a shoot in a refugee camp in Greece. And, you know, Whit Freeze and Dan Brown got on a plane, met the crew there and shot. And it was real shooting in the camp that turned the promo. And it was just a really strong piece. And while it was a really strong piece for the viewers, what it also did is it also gave a focus for the CNN family, for the journalists to really focus on that this is what CNN, great reporting and listening to people and telling the world about what's happening in the world, really brought into focus for the CNN family what we do. So it was special in that it was a really good piece of creative that came out of an idea and great execution on that idea. But it also delivered on talking internally to CNN as well. And that's sometimes what we forget in marketing. It's not just about the viewers. The viewers are really important, but there's other audiences that we need to think about when we're doing marketing, because we're speaking about the whole company, and you need to think about what's the message you're delivering to the people who work at your company as well. And they need to be proud of the promotion. And one of the great things that I always enjoyed was people at CNN coming up to me, and you know, people who'd worked there for decades, saying, thanking me, because CNN had never looked better than it did it during my time there, because of what we did to showcase CNN and tell the story of CNN.
So two things on that. One, I feel pretty strongly that we ran this That Go There campaign, so I will try to dig it up and along with this, because I really remember the footage of the reporter in the camp.
Yeah, and I know it's a different organization, but one of those Emmys behind me, we won for that that spot as well, and we won a lot of Pro Max awards for that one.
Yeah, well, that was my other point, is that you've won a lot of Pro Max awards in general. Oh, and I was also going to say, I think that just to expand on what you were saying about promoting the brand internally, but I think also a spot like that did a good job of establishing and reminding people what is CNN's brand mission. And it wasn't like it hit us over the head with it, but it was clearly like, this is what we're here to do. This is how we're here to serve our audience, is what we're here to do. But did it in a way that was simple, but visually arresting and very clear. So I think that is it's kind of like hits everything you want out of a spot. You know, yep. You don't have too much time to do it. All right, so that was Go There. I mean, some campaigns I have loved from CNN. I loved the history of comedy spots, and also the history of late night spots. And then one that I had already told you I was going to ask you about, one that won a lot of awards, was the Donkey and Elephant campaign, which was a very beautiful and simply illustrated campaign. And like, it looked like it was done in like pencil or pen drawings. And then the mission I just think they were very effective. And actually, then I also want to talk to you about the Apple Orange campaign, which I didn't down, but we talk about, because that won a lot of awards too. But let's start off with Donkey and Elephant, which came out, I believe, in 2020. It covered a lot of things that were going on at the time, COVID, political divisiveness, et cetera. It was right ahead of the election. What was the origin of that campaign? How did you guys conceive it, and how did it ultimately evolve?
Typically, when we go into a campaign, what we would do is somewhere between 8 and 10 different kind of concepts of what we were doing. And so, you know, this was part of the campaign for the 2020 election. We would take these different concepts, and we would go to different creative partners quite often if it was something as big as the 2020 election. And we would, you know, we could invite a couple of different creative agencies to come up with ideas. And then, you know, we would start from probably 30 to 50 different ideas, and we would kind of cull it down to our, you know, 8 favorites. And then we would take it to Jeff Zucker and Allison Gollist, and we would pitch those ideas. And for something like the election, you don't just have one campaign. That's a year-long thing. You need a bunch of different ideas. And the idea for Donkey and Elephant, which was a claymation spot, actually came from Fig, the agency that also did Apple and Banana for us.
Okay.
And they're not, or weren't at the time we started working with them, a traditional broadcast kind of agency, but we'd known about them and we liked their work. So we really liked Donkey and Elephant, and we decided to pitch it as part of it. And, you know, either something clicks in the pitch or it doesn't. And Jeff really liked it. Now, obviously, you can't sell the whole election, but what it really did was it set up humor, which is always good, and people never thought of using humor in news marketing, but we always liked humor. It kind of poked fun at both sides in the election, and we didn't take a stand with it. It was just kind of there. It was one of those spots that people just warmed up to. We didn't buy any external advertising for donkey and elephant. Everything we got for it either ran on CNN or it was earned media. And that was the kind of spot that was just shared all
over.
Got
a lot of earned, yeah, got a lot of earned media.
Yeah, and you know, what's good creative? Hard to tell, but you know,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You see it. We saw that and it was one of those things, oh, let's hope that that Jeff and Allison love this one because we would love to do it. And to their credit, they went for it.
That, okay, so it's so funny that I remember it as like pen and ink. So I'll also go through and post that one again, although we ran a lot of donkey and elephant spots. But
yeah, it did have the look of pen and ink because it was actually based kind of on, you know, the really old, century-old kind of political cartoons.
Yes.
But we just put it into 3D with the claymation.
But I think the thing about those spots that resonated with me is that you're right, they were humorous, but they were very gentle. And it was like, if these two people on the far side of the aisle could like sit on this park bench and sort of just have a reasonable conversation, wouldn't it be a lovely world? And it was sort of something I think at the time that we were all longing for a little bit. And it was also nice to be like, oh, I don't feel bludgeoned by this. I feel like calm and, you know, and that the discourse is in control. I don't know. I felt like it was a very soothing spot at a time where nothing felt very soothing. Or campaign, not really a spot. There were a lot of spots. Okay. And then I called it apples and oranges, but it was apples and bananas. So that was the same year. So tell me about that. And that was also from Fig. And then I want to talk about Fig.
That was the first time we worked on a project that big with Fig. And so this was kind of at the height of the discourse and you know, a real shift in how we handled it as a news organization, because it was uncharted territory being under attack by the White House. Again, we had to look at how we put ourselves out there and you know, we Go There was still a fresh campaign, but Go There didn't work in this new environment, and we needed to do something different and what that was. And so we did what we called a range of creative concepts. The range went from, you know, a real traditional kind of spot with edited news footage that talked how great CNN would be, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, range of spots all the way to the wacky, which was apple and banana. Like, who talks? And it was originally just apple. The banana wasn't even there to begin with. In this case, it was so important at the time. We didn't pitch it just to Jeff and Allison, but Jeff wanted me to pitch it to his whole executive team because he wanted everyone to have buy-in. And so we pitched it, and the room was almost divided. You know, there are people who got apple and banana and people who thought we should really be very news and buttoned down in how we presented ourselves. We went around and around and around, and Jeff was really, really good at listening to people's opinion. The meeting kind of broke up and people left the room. It ended up just being Jeff and I sitting there, and we just chatted about it really briefly. He just kind of turned to me, let out an expletive, and said, "Go for it."
That's the beauty of being the boss.
Yeah, and so, you know, I walked out and gave Witt a high five. Apple and banana started, and here again, that was probably the most successful spot from an earned media standpoint ever done. We got millions and millions and millions. Again, we never bought a single piece of external advertising. It ended up on, you're thinking of the orange because...
That was later, I think.
No, we never used the orange. It was actually Ellen DeGeneres who used the orange. She pulled the orange out and said, "Let this represent the president." And
that's funny.
and it became so kind of ingrained in people at that time. And the one place that I really smiled was there was a time Kellyanne Conway was on the White House lawn being interviewed, I think by Jake Tapper. They were in a little bit of back and forth on it. And Kellyanne Conway said to Jake Tapper, "Now be an apple, don't be a banana." And when that happened, I just kind of went, okay, We've broken through,
Yeah,
we've
we're
broken
done.
through.
Our work here is done. Yeah, so that was
Exactly.
another campaign, though, where I felt like it kind of, it spoke to the moment and it transcended CNN. But it's not like you lost, like people knew that I think that that campaign was from CNN, but it was like Go There to me was clearly CNN and about the CNN mission, whereas Apple and Banana was about the environment at large. And how are we as a news organization and really as a country and as a society trying to have these conversations, how are we navigating it? So I felt like it was it was almost like a public service announcement to people, like calm down and also try to speak in reality.
Exactly. And, those are the kind of things you don't have a lot of those campaigns that come along in your career, but boy, they're memorable when they happen.
Yeah, two and almost three in a very short space of time.
Yeah, it was a short space of time. We had to do a lot of work, a lot really strong. And at the same time, like we mentioned, we were launching shows, the history of comedy and all of that. And what we loved about those programs was that the Anderson Coopers and Don Lemons played along we fun spots with them, and it intertwined original series with our news people, and people had trust in what we were doing with our marketing, and they would play around and they would do things with us. The stuff we did for New Year's Eve, particularly with Anderson and Andy, and we did a spot for New Year's Eve for New Year's Eve 2020. That was Anderson and Andy singing a musical called 2021 Might Not Suck.
And yes, I remember this spot, yeah.
To be able to get Anderson to go and do a song and dance, which is not his comfort zone for us, showed a lot of trust.
Let's talk a little bit about FIG and then how you ended up working with FIG on those two campaigns we just discussed. And then I also want to just talk to you in general about how you determine what agencies you're going to work with and why. But let's start with FIG.
FIG came from a relationship that Whit Fries had. FIG had not done, I'm not sure they'd done any work in the broadcast field. They'd done a lot of advocacy, marketing, promotion, but they were just somebody different who hadn't done anything in this theater. And so it started out of, the campaign that became Apple and Banana. We had a bunch of agencies, people we worked with a lot, and we tried some new people. And Whit said, let's try this group, let's see if they've got a different approach to how they think about things. I was very open to that. One of the reasons that I hired Whit in the first place was he had no background in television news, zero, and hadn't worked in broadcast marketing to a great degree. So I'm a big advocate for trying things that aren't traditional. What did we have to lose by trying something new? And it turned out to be a beautiful relationship for us.
I think that makes sense too, because that's why Apple and Banana and Donkey and Elephant looked so different than most things you see in news promos. Like, I don't think I've ever seen campaigns that really look like that in news campaigns.
Yeah, and that's nothing against all the other great partners we work with. It was just the right people at the right time to do something interesting.
But for all the agency listeners out there, what are some of the things you look for when you're looking to partner with an agency?
I learned really on, I look for an agency that will listen to us. Back in my days at CTV, just when we'd taken over the network and we had to do a rebrand for CTV because the brand was in horrible shape, we hired a company which has birthed a lot of the great people in the industry today called Pittard Sullivan. And Pittard Sullivan were the giants in the industry at that time. And I remember clearly, before we had hired them, Billy Pittard came up to Toronto and he sat in our boardroom, and we'd had a bunch of agencies, and all these agencies had come in, and the first thing they did, they had storyboards, they were pitching stuff and everything else. And Billy Pittard opened up an empty notebook and started asking us questions and getting us talking. He didn't come in there and tell us what we needed to do. He came in and listened to what we had to say and then went away. So he didn't come in with preconceived ideas. And I think that's really important for agency people to do. Don't think you have to come in with a hot pitch right away. Take your time, listen to what the client needs, like really listen. Don't think you know things until you listen. If you do that, I think you'll learn a little bit as well and maybe come up with some better ideas than what you would do if you just came in blind with a pitch.
Do you think with agencies, like how important is it to you that A, you sort of are familiar with their previous work, B, that you have a pre-existing relationship with them? I mean, is it really more about what are the ideas that you're bringing to the table, or do you sort of want to know? Like one thing I hear a lot is that agents say sometimes we get clients because they're looking for a specific style and that's a style that we provide. And then they sometimes feel like, oh, we get pigeonholed into that. So for you, how much do you consider that previous work, or what are some of the things you look for before you even get to the listening stage, just in inviting them into the room?
It's a lot about, you know, people you know, who is working for the agency. It's not always the person leading the agency, but who do they have? What editors do they work with? You know, who are their producers? Have those people been with them for a while, or are they always having to bring in new talent? And you can kind of tell a lot about what you're probably going to get out of an agency. Yeah, look at the reels, but the reels aren't important to me, because anyone can put together a reel, and who really worked on that reel. You know, I could put a reel together for you, and the truth is that I had very little to do with the actual creative of most of those reels. Most of it was me approving the creative. I take reels with a grain of sand.
Let's talk about that for a second, which is you've been in positions for a long time of creative leadership, which means you aren't, you know, producing the creative yourself, but you certainly have to be very in touch with what it is you're seeking creatively, what you want to see, what you want to get. How do you feel? What are the qualities of being a good leader of creatives and also of being a good creative leader?
If you're leading creatives, you need some background in being a creative, whatever it is. You know, Whit's background is in design. Mine's in shooting and editing and writing. I probably consider myself a writer first and foremost, even though I write very little now. So you need some background so you know what you're talking about, that you're not just somebody who came out of school with a degree that tells you how to manage people. And then it's hire the best people you can. Don't be afraid to hire people who are better at you at things than you are. Every one of my designers I had was a better designer than me. I wasn't afraid of that. I'm not afraid of having people who are better writers working for me. I want the best people because I learn from them as well. You know, the things I've learned in the last 10 years, it's been phenomenal. It's been excellent. And then keep an open mind. I always tell people there's 10 different ways to do a promo for anything, at least 10 different ways to do a promo for anything, and they can all work. So we're just going to, you know, settle on one of them, but don't get locked in that there's only one way to do this. There's got to be different ways to do it. My former staff will tell you I can be a bit of a hard ass, but nobody's ever afraid that, you know, I yell at situations. I don't yell at people. And we have hard discussions on stuff, but it's always in a safe environment.
You know, you're Canadian. Are you actually yelling?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I part of the problem is just the tenor of my voice can sound like I'm yelling sometimes, and I'm really not. I'm just talking. But I get passionate when I talk. And so, you know, I have passionate conversations about stuff, and I like discussions, and I like people pushing back. When I have to tell somebody for the fourth time that I want a voiceover at the end of the spot and just don't put up a title card and expect that people are going to read the day, date, and time. Yeah, I get a little cranky when I've had to say that for the third promo in a row.
Yeah. How important do you feel that it is to, as a leader, to build trust with your team, since you're asking them, you know, to display some vulnerabilities when they come, you know, when they're trying to bring ideas to the table?
Absolutely critical, and it started from day one when I came to CNN, and I was given the opportunity with a blank slate to have a blank slate. I could have wiped out the team that was there completely. Like I'd been given that much carte blanche. I chose not to, because they were all really good creative people in their own rights. They'd just been working in the news media, and they did news promos. And I just needed to get them to understand that there are other ways to promote news other than just doing news promos. They were willing to work with me and move in different directions. I was willing to work with them. And, there's great people. Sean Houston's an excellent creative director who was there when I got there, but Sean's background had all been in news. By the time, 10 years later, Sean was the one behind a lot of those great campaigns for original series, like History of the Sitcom and stuff. That was Sean's work. And this was a guy when I came there who was only doing news promotion. Expanded. So if you show the willingness to trust people and give them the environment to work in and help them, and don't tell them their work is crap, but help them think about it in different ways, then it works. And we kind of had a rule in our group that, and I talked openly with everybody all the time, right up until the very end, that anyone could ask me anything, and I would answer them honestly. I would tell them the truth when it was there. I would tell them when I knew something and I wasn't able to tell them, and I would tell them when I didn't know. As long as they felt that I was being honest with them, then they trusted in what I did. And having people who trust you leads to respect. Demanding respect doesn't get you respect.
Yeah, and I think in those positions, respect for on both sides is not just respect flowing upwards, but them feeling like they're respected. I mean, yeah. It certainly goes hand in hand for us. But I do think I'm sure in all jobs it's important to have respect and trust flowing both ways, but I do think in the creative crafts, all the more so, because you are putting yourself out there a little bit more.
We had honest conversations, and I used times of what was happening in society for us to have those discussions. So when the first kind of sense of the Me Too movement was starting, I brought my group together and I just said, we're going to talk about respect of everybody here. I told them bluntly that I would not put up with anybody doing any of the kind of stuff, the misogyny and everything we're hearing about. And I had these open conversations with people. It opened up some wounds, but I had two women come to me and talk to me afterwards about how they had situations like that happening to them around them, not within our department, but around them, and help them through it. And having those kind of really, really open conversations about how we needed to respect each other was the only way we really did respect each other, was to know that we didn't put up with anything, whether it was about sexual orientation, color of your skin, male, female, it didn't matter. And that brought so much diversity in so many different ways that people were comfortable having those conversations and moving that forward.
Yeah, that's a whole different layer than what I was talking about, which is really more about trust and respect on the work level. But
if you don't have that respect on the human level, then your respect on the work level isn't going to be as deep. You have to respect yourselves as human beings first and foremost. And that's sometimes, it goes beyond just being respectful of work. It's being respectful of the person as a human.
Do you feel like that, knowing that and how to bring that into teams, was something that developed after 30, 40 years in the business? It seems like obvious when you talk about it, but I don't think it's something that a lot of people think about bringing into their leadership or into their work.
You know, it honestly started really, really early for me. You know, I'm a baby boomer. I'm an old guy. I was brought up in a different time, but my wife and I both worked for the same TV station where we met. I was hired almost exactly a year before my wife. We had the exact same job, and when I was hired, I got paid $825 a month. My wife was hired the next year, and she got paid $750 for the same job. The only difference was she was a woman and I was a guy. That stuck with me and has stuck with me all the way along, that there's people who look at you and decide what your value is based on what they see about you. And so that little lesson that early in my career has kind of driven my desire to make sure that people are treated equally.
All right, I'm going to veer from that conversation into the future. So, a big conversation happening right now in the world is about artificial intelligence and creative graphic art writing that's created by artificial intelligence, AI. How do you think that when you look out a little bit, what kind of role do you think AI is going to play in entertainment marketing?
A bigger role than it should. It's a trend I've noticed that's happening more and more. And I've said for years there's creative people and there's marketing people. And there used to be this balance, this yin and yang, between marketing people and creative people. And that balance has been sliding more and more and more to the marketing side. You know, obviously coming from the creative side first and foremost, that concerns me. I think we have the people who are controlling our marketing promotion groups more and more so are people who need to have ROI. And ROI is, you know, is a great acronym, and I hate most of the acronyms in the marketing world. But if you need to show return on investment before you start a campaign, you're destined to be mediocre. If you think that data is going to solve all of your marketing problems, you will be average because everybody can access data. Data is a tool and it needs to be used as a tool. But AI doesn't have a human factor, and the human factor is really important. Yeah, it can choose the most popular image. And I had this fight for years with people from the digital side of my business who wanted to use the feedback they were getting from data about which images we should use for promoting different things on digital. Well, all the data shows that Anderson Cooper is the most popular person on CNN. And because of that, they wanted to use Anderson Cooper's image on everything they were doing on digital, which is great, but that doesn't help you in the really big picture. So if the data is telling you should only be using Anderson Cooper and you believe the data and you only use Anderson Cooper, what happens to your image as a network if the only person you have out there is Anderson Cooper? And that's a kind of problem that you have with following the data and following, you know, doing what AI does. And yeah, AI can you can you there's a programs now that will do promos for you with no human input, but they're generic. They check all the boxes, but they're generic. And no AI program is ever going to do apple and banana for you. It's never going to do donkey and elephant for you. And you will check all the boxes. You will be able to show that what your ROI is and how people are registering with it. And you will be bland and you will be boring. And you will forget that this is show business. You need the show and you need the business. And I worry about it. Sorry, long answer there. I
Yeah,
worry
but
about it.
no, you bring up good points because I also think there's I mean, just to drill down a little bit on what you just said, but I think, you know, with the advent of growth marketing, and same thing with digital, because you can basically say, I want, you know, X number of impressions, that requires me to buy X number of whatever CPMs or however you say it in world of digital, but it's math, right? Like, you're coming up with an equation that says this is how many times we need to hit people to get what we want. And you're right, it takes that piece out of it, which is, let's go back to Donkey and Elephant, a piece of great creative where you can't predict where that's going to go. Like, you don't know until it lands.
Correct. And you know, the math will tell you that people who watch CNN, pick a show, you know, will watch this inane comedy. And yeah, people don't just watch news. They watch different things. But what it doesn't tell you, it'll tell you, you can find those people who watch news
right.
in this program, let's say Jackass, for example. But what it doesn't tell you, which intuitively you know, is people probably aren't in the frame of mind about thinking about the war in Ukraine while they're watching Jackass. And so even though they may be news viewers, that's not the time to reach them because they're not in that mindset. The algorithm will tell you, well, you can reach them there, so that's got to be a good place to reach them. No, it doesn't. Sometimes you need to use a little bit of human logic to figure out what the data is telling you.
The other piece about that I always wonder about is there's always a lot of conversation about doing the research and finding the audiences and then where to find them, et cetera, like you just said. But what if you're doing Donkey and Elephant and you strike somebody that hasn't occurred to them in 10 years to watch CNN? I just feel like if you're too targeted, you lose the ability, you lose the reach to some extent, and the reach, you don't know who that's going to net.
Absolutely. You've got to put some logical thinking into it that isn't a simple math equation.
What do you think sort of the next trend, where do you think entertainment marketing is going?
I think we're going into a real follow period right now. I think the industry as a whole is struggling, and with it, marketing will struggle as well. I think it could be kind of boring for the next 5 years or so until the next spark comes along, the next thing that's going to change it. You know, one of the reasons I'm getting directly out of doing it right now is I think we had a really good kind of two decades for marketing for entertainment, but until streaming gets sorted out and we know how to make money off of streaming, I think we're going to be struggling in the marketing side of things, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, it has been a rough month. If you look at layoffs and consolidation and some earnings reports, and even more than a month, been the end of this year has been tough, I think.
I think fundamentally, you know, as much as anything, I think COVID really changed our society in ways that we haven't figured out yet. You know, we're not back to where we were, and things happened with streaming during COVID because people were staying home. There's a lot of unknowns that what the world went through with COVID still needs to sort out. I don't know where it's going to end up, but it's in disarray right now.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think what's going to happen with theatrical and movies, what's going to happen with work? Are you people going to go to work or stay home? What's going to happen? Yeah. And then even, you know, now people are behaving as if there isn't COVID, but in so many instances, when people get together, you hear about people coming away having gotten sick. So it's certainly not really over either. So I agree.
It's not. And, you know, look, it's fundamentally changed for me. I don't get on an airplane or go in an airport without wearing a mask now. And I was just traveling last week, and, you know, where I was traveling was not a COVID hotspot, but the flu was. And so now that I've got the option to put a mask on, I'm going to put that mask on. 4 years ago, I would have looked at anyone wearing a mask in an airplane as if they were crazy. Now it's going to be commonplace. We've just fundamentally changed so much in how we do things now. I haven't been to a movie theater since before COVID.
Well, you have a movie theater, so you don't need to go.
but still, you know, we just really do things really, really different than we used to.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, though. Like, what will history say about this time period, and how will we see that fundamentally change things? And we're in it, so we.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're in it right now. Like, we're not on the other side of it. We're in it right now to see what's going to happen to society. And it's a coin flip.
The degree that you can say, what's next for you?
Look, I'm done working full time. You know,
Well,
I figured it out.
congratulations.
I've been working with a full-time job or part-time during college, but actually working since I was 15 years old. I'm 62 now. I haven't had a week between jobs or anything else. I've been working for that whole time. That's enough. I need some breaks in between. But I love this business, and I think I've got a lot to offer. So, you know, I'm going to look for projects to work on with people. I would really love to get back in working with local television promotion people again. I watch a lot of local television news promotion, and a lot of it is just like 25 degrees off. And I think a lot of people could just use a little bit of coaching in a non-threatening way to help them kind of get on side a little bit. I would love to do that kind of work. It's not about the money, it's just about keeping active and doing that sort of thing. So I'm hoping that will work out, but I don't have hard and fast plans at this point in time.
Well, just the local television idea, I think, is so interesting. And at a time when local TV is an interesting place, right? Because I think what is the media in the local space is so much less than it used to be. So local TV has so much opportunity, but they're also at a hard spot because they're being asked to sort of change drastically what they do and how they do it while still doing what they do every day, all day long. So they have a really hard time pivoting in ways that maybe they need to. So I think that they could probably really benefit from some outside help, like consulting and eyes.
I think, you know, I could probably go into a local TV station and in less than a month, just point out some really simple things they could do to change to be more effective in what they're doing, just because they're so deep in the forest, they're just not
Yeah.
seeing what's going on.
Well, even on the group level, you know, I mean, with now they're all giant groups essentially. Next or Sinclair Gray could go, you know, could have a lot of impact going in a high level. I mean, there's great work being done, but I do think with local TV stations, there's so much opportunity there. So, you know, how do you tap into it? And especially with the resources that we have.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of them are doing some really good promotion work, but then I look where they're scheduling the promos, and I'm going, do you know the audience you're talking to, where you're running this spot? And I'm not sure that kind of next level thinking about what they do with the creative once they get good creative is really happening, and well, as well as it could be.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna leave it there. Rick, thank you so much for your time. I love this conversation. I felt like we got a little deep, which I appreciate. Have a wonderful holiday.
You too. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye, Rick. That's it for this episode of the Daily Brief podcast. If you don't already, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments, questions, or ideas for conversations, please feel free to reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org. And as always, thanks for listening.